So we are about to start our panel discussion, and I just want to introduce our fourth guest, which hasn't been introduced yet, and that is Theo Jäkel. Theo is a researcher at Swedwatch, an organization that I think most of you here know. And if not, it's an independent non-profit organization reporting on the activities of Swedish business in developing countries. Swedwatch cover a range of sectors and focus on social and environmental business ethics. Theo is also working as head lecturer and co-responsible for development of the master course Business and Human Rights at Stockholm University Faculty of Law. And he also has experience from Transparency International in Sweden. So, everyone, feel free to have a seat. Yeah. So, again, welcome to the panel. We'll take a few introductory questions, and then I will open up for questions from the audience. So my first question goes to you, Theo, because we haven't heard you yet. So you've worked with these issues for a long time, and you have a general perception of how the situation is. So when you read this report and when you hear the conclusions here, do you agree with them? Are they in line with your own perceptions? Or was there anything in the report which surprised you or stood out as, you know, different?
I totally agree with the conclusions that, I was one of the middle group who raised my hand that I maybe feel that Sweden is on the right track, but far from the finish line. Because we really see today a commitment from the Swedish government to these issues, and that is clear in the report as well, that there is a commitment to the union GPs and an expectation of business. But unfortunately, I would say that it sometimes stops at a commitment or an expectation from business. There is no clear requirements, and that is what we have, in our dialogue with the Swedish government, said many times, that there needs to be more than just an expectation. There needs to be requirements, and if you require and expect something of private enterprises, you need to show that you also require this of your own state-owned businesses and agencies. So to that extent, I'm not really surprised that the state-owned companies are in the forefront compared to the agencies.
And why is it that the companies are in forefront, you mean?
Because the report also says, the approach when working with the UN Guiding Principles has, to a large extent, been focused on the second pillar and the responsibility of businesses. And sometimes I feel that the government neglects their own responsibilities when it comes to the first pillar and doesn't look at those principles and see, are we actually in line? Do we create this enabling environment, or are our laws and regulations in Sweden, are those enabling companies to actually report or actually comply with their responsibilities? So therefore, I'm not surprised that the business side has come are in the forefront.
Okay. And what would you say are the main weaknesses if you look at the state performance? Do you have any concrete examples?
One thing that is also very positive, I would say, with the National Action Plan, one thing that we have brought up in our dialogue with the government is education of the, for example, embassies and the Business Sweden and other agencies of the government abroad, to align respect of human rights with the Swedish export. That is something that we have seen is lacking, and it's positive that the government is now taking action.
Okay. And if I ask the same question to you, Elin, now you gave us a summary, but you have read different national action plans, you have this broad international perspective. Was there anything in this analysis which stood out as surprising, extraordinary, good or bad or different?
As I said, I think what one of the important points is really how you would expect that state agencies are performing better than companies, because you expect that the state has had the obligation to respect, protect, and fulfill human rights since the UN conventions were ratified. So it's not new to them. So you would expect that they and they have to act by example, so that I would really expect that the state was on the forefront of that, whereas I can see why it is not the case, because there has been so much pressure, there has been a lot of media around negative impacts of businesses, so they are also probably more pragmatic, and where they see a risk that is tangible and material, then they act to address it if they see sufficient pressure from civil society and on their reputation to act. So I would say they probably are quicker to move in some sense. But I'd like also to say that the call on states to act is... It's not recent, but 5 years' time for a UN instrument and seeing how the UN guiding principles have been taken up by so many governments now, I think it's still we're still on a journey, and it's only the start. It's not that long, 5 years, for any international instrument. So I would say it's not very surprising that states are a bit slow to act on this. And again, I think the field of international cooperation has not really been high on the agenda of the implementation of the UN guiding principles. That's why I think this report is really interesting. There hasn't been much debate around this. There are so many maybe issues that have been deemed to be more urgent that this has maybe fallen a little bit off the agenda.
And Sandra, you worked with developing the guidelines together with Professor John Draghi. So do you think 5 years is a short time or a long time? If you look at the situation now, you know, I think quite little focus has been devoted to the relation between the UN guiding principles and development cooperation. Was that what you foresaw, or do you have any reflections on why we haven't come further, or do you think we actually have come quite far in 5 years?
I think it really depends on the perspective. On the one side, as you said, Ellen, it's not a long time for an international instrument. On the other hand side, Sweden has such a strong reputation and a strong interest in being one of the leading countries in terms of human rights. So I actually was expecting more from the ministries, perhaps. I think that there are lots of the good practice that we found in a lot of the organizations and companies was maybe what we had expected, or at least I, but I think that maybe I had a little higher expectations of the ministries. And I think that 5 years is long enough. It's not like it's, you know, I think the National Action Plan could have been faster here, and I think it could have been also taken a stronger focus, given that there is such an urge to involve private sector in development cooperation.
Right, so I'll open up for a couple of questions, and perhaps in the first round, I can ask those of you who work for the agencies in this study, if you would like to make a brief comment or have specific questions. I know you had an interesting meeting before here, so perhaps every question mark is straightened out already. But I think it would be of interest for the rest of the audience just to hear briefly your reflections. And please try to keep your comments brief and to the point.
And please say who you are and where you come from.
Thank you. So my name is Ola Pettersson. I'm heading SIDA's Unit for Private Sector Collaboration and Partnerships. And initially, we really welcome this study, and we take on a lot of lessons from it, which will really be useful for us as we develop our policies on this important topic further. And I think especially with regards to consistency on how we apply the policies and procedures that we really have. So thank you so much for that. And also, the discussion we've had initially with you has been really useful as well, and we look forward to continue that discussion. Maybe just to clarify, I mean, as we see it, this study mainly concerns our relation to the private sector as an indirect partner in the collaboration in the development interventions that we do. We normally do not provide direct financial support to the private sector. And then in every development intervention that we have, we do a comprehensive and mandatory analysis of the human rights impact and risks. And that is always publicly available. And in that, we also have a human rights-based approach with a focus on businesses, which was developed just last year. And then in addition to that, we do the due diligence and the direct study of the private sector that we partner with, which is, the, as I see, the focus of this study. And that's really useful, and we have a lot of work to do on that regard. And I then maybe also to echo what you said initially, it's unfortunate for us that there is so few initiatives concerning the mining sector in Africa, because I think it would be really useful for us to have looked at, if the study had looked at interventions that we have done after the UNGPs were finalized, because I think we've done a lot of work since then, but that's something that we will follow up internally as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Christine Sjöblom, and I work as a sustainability manager at Swedfund. First, I just wanted to say that we are happy with the result of the study, but we know that we have a long way to go to really implement the UN guiding principle. So we have started, but we have a lot more to do. One reflection I made when I read the report and the result, why we have come a little bit further than the other state institutions, I think that is very much thanks to, or the pressure, thanks to, or from the civil society. I mean, we are scrutinized in every case we do and every investment we do. And we have also developed as a company and have much more regular contacts with the NGOs and civil society organization. And I think also one reason is that we are doing business with private industry. And there is a lot of companies out there that has come very far in the way of implementing the UN guiding principles, and we learn from them. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Can I follow up on this?
We can have perhaps a brief comment.
Yeah. Is that right? Just while people are thinking, I just thought it was interesting you took up that point, Ola, about CEDA's human rights-based approach. I think you raised that earlier as well. And that's one of the things we've been discussing. I mean, what are the additional elements that come in to consideration when you need to do human rights due diligence under the guiding principles in relationship to CEDA's more general human rights-based approach? And I think maybe you want to discuss that more, and I would certainly love to take that discussion forward as well, I think, Sandra, as well. And then just a reflection, just to help also the conversation, I think, in relation to your comment, Theo, about the steering from the ministries and the state. I mean, we mentioned that in the report, but we don't go into that in detail. But I think this raises questions also. I mean, what is an adequate level of steering? And, of course, there are different theories or preferences, political preferences as well. But, I mean, we are very aware, and we discussed that with those of you that we have interviewed also today, that I mean, in the five institutions, you're working within constraints, a structural constraint from above. And I think that's sort of, that would be a larger question that would be, I would love to see taken forward after this discussion. Where should the responsibility lie to change those conditions? Because I think we all agree that those conditions are not competing right at this moment. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Zero Akyol, and I actually also work at CEDA. And if it's okay, actually, just a comment. So I'm thinking that for advocacy purposes, and maybe it's because I'm a bit slow myself that I'm not getting certain things in my mind this afternoon. So I think that for advocacy purposes, because we want to be able to use a report like this in a very practical manner. So for advocacy purposes, I think that it would be very useful to, in very plain and succinct language, to identify what is the burning issue or issues. What are the burning issues? And what are the consequences of not addressing these burning issues? And then the last point is, how do we instill a sense of urgency? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll let the panel respond to that, but perhaps one or two additional questions first.
My name is Jukke Nyberg. I'm a human rights evaluator, independent. I wonder if you, a question to Rasmus and Sandra, did you run into any examples when you during the study related to African mining industries where Swedish had some interest, maybe through state-controlled pension funds on the one hand, and where CEDAW provided project support to people who protested against human rights violations of these companies. How should these clash of interests be addressed?
So the first question was from Sida. You know, the burning issues and consequences of not addressing these questions.
I think this is the case of when you are trying to address something before something bad has hit the media, it might not be as perceived as burning or as sexy, if you will. Nevertheless, I think that what we're talking about is, for some organizations, the business case might be to avoid a front page of what Swedish aid money has contributed to. So obviously what we would like to avoid and what could happen if this is not addressed is that in the future there is a scrutiny by someone as Theo or other that finds that Swedish aid money or development cooperation money has indirectly or directly gone to actors where, because of gut feelings being used rather than systems and procedures, making sure that human rights risks are prevented, human rights violations have been caused, linked to Swedish taxpayers' money. I think that's one of the issues. But we don't have a case yet. We don't have a case, Swedwatch case or other, that says, look here what happened with Swedish aid money. But if you want to really put it to the point, I think that's what happens. And for us to get it urgent is really to talk to the agencies and companies, and I think the response we have gotten from every single one of them has been that we really want to take this on and do this ASAP. So I think that's where the urgency is. It's not on the front pages, but it's still urgent internally.
Theo?
I also think that question of urgency is credibility. I mean, when we speak to companies, we often hear if the government is expecting something of us or requiring something of us, why don't they first lead by example? And I think that if reports like this show that agencies and state-owned companies lag behind private companies, then that might be a question of lack of credibility. And if you want the private sector to improve and be in the forefront, you need to lead by example first. So I think that is a very sense of urgency to instill credibility.
Rasmus?
Yeah, I thought I would follow up on your question about examples. We did actually meet the Ethics Council, the pension funds, and tried to sort of consider that, including them in the study, but we said no to that because we were focusing on development aid, so we have not pursued that inquiry. But we did come across, CEDAW involvement in, I think you would say, support to resistance or protest, I think, in Congo, or at least we're very focused working in more than civil society. So those examples exist. And we had that discussion early on, Sandra and I as well, how broadly could we showcase all the support that Sweden's given to broader human rights work, law reforms and so on. But this study has considered specifically what we're discussing today. And then just to say that the sense of urgency, I think Sandra and I also consciously tried to avoid basing the study on a hot potato or on a specific case. I think perhaps many of us in here are aware of cases that are a bit contentious where Sweden is involved in different areas, but we did not want this study to be based on that. We want this study to be exploring and using data that we could discuss with those of you who are here today, and I think that's been the purpose of this report. Yeah.
Do you want to add something, Elin? You have worked with a wide range of actors internationally, so you have faced many of these burning issues.
There has been cases where development aid has been linked to abuses. I don't know of any Swedish case, and good for you, but it might come, and it would be better if it doesn't come. And in that sense, I'm also thinking of what sort of grievance mechanisms are available for people. Not only for people who might be affected by business channeled development aid, but for, by development aid in general, and that's something that is on the radar. And I think, you know, that is also something that you generally do not think about until you have cases that are coming up, and then people do devise grievance mechanisms to try to tackle these issues, whereas I think a preventative approach is probably what you need to be doing and have all the procedures and processes in place, as well as a serious engagement with people that might be affected by projects before it happens. Then, you know, it can always, even though you would have the best procedures in the world, there might be things that will happen, but then you will be ready to address those issues as early as possible before serious harm is done. Of course, institutional development cooperation is usually much better at looking at which project it selects and how it monitors the impact, etc. But there are many stories out there about multilateral institutions that you all know about where there has been serious human rights abuses. And, you know, if the World Bank and the IFC have solid standards today, it is because there have been so many cases. It's not just because they wanted to be up there and have the good procedures up front. So I would really urge to... for a country like Sweden, who has a great reputation in terms of development cooperation, to have it really well managed from the start and be an example for other countries in that regard.
Theo, you mentioned that Swedish business has high profile internationally, and perhaps the state is sort of lagging behind. What do you think that people here today working practically with the questions, what can they learn from Swedish business? You know, big question.
Yeah, big question. I think they can learn today a lot of businesses aren't as afraid of these issues as they might have been a few years ago. I mean, talking about mandatory regulations or human rights due diligence, impact assessments, and the UN guiding principles in general. I mean, this is, many companies have... good systems in place on dealing with these issues. So I think sometimes when we speak to the government, there is a fear of talking about regulation, for example, that this is going to damage companies, we're going to create boundaries, we're going to... And that is, I mean, today I see a shift that a lot of big companies want a level playing field. They want the bottom line to go up. So I think that... the ministries and the agencies shouldn't be afraid to commit to stronger regulations and enforcement. I think that the business will just welcome it.
Right. And so I look at you now, Elin. If we look, you know, to the business on one side hand to get inspiration, and another source of inspiration could perhaps be the other national action plans and best practice, pick here and there from other countries. So if anyone here seeks inspiration, where should they look, given your international benchmarking?
The only work that has been done so far to look at the different national action plans have come from civil society, and we have been urging different multilateral institutions, and in particular the EU, to be thinking of some sort of peer learning or peer review of national action plans, because... we have come up with some criteria for national action plans, but we're just a national human rights institution, and we've done that because we thought there was a need. The UN Working Group has developed some guidance, so there is a little bit of guidance out there for states, but it's really an emerging tool. I mean, you counted eight plans. I'm not even sure all of them have been really launched totally, so... there's very few. There are a number of plans that are going to come up, so I think it's time to set up some sort of mechanism to be looking at the quality of these national action plans in terms of what are they actually looking at, all the spectrum of the UN guiding principles that are touching upon so many different policy fields that the state will undoubtedly have to prioritize a number of fields and cannot tackle everything from the start, but it's, I think it would be very interesting to have some sort of peer learning going on, especially in specific areas, let it be on public procurement, on state-owned enterprises, on development aid, on reporting. I mean, there's a number of issues that states could be discussing amongst themselves. And there should probably be some sort of, not rating, but at least some quality assurance about those national action plans to make sure that they actually do provide something new. One thing that we are missing in many of the plans is a solid monitoring or follow-up mechanism. Who is actually going to implement all these measures? Is there a timeline for the things that are announced by the state? Who is responsible? Are there any specific ministries that are responsible for certain areas? This is something that is still weak in many of the plans that we see so far.